Chiri's awakened interest in her appearance was a sign of growing up. And for a Skywalker, growing up meant the end of her third sight now loomed on the horizon. Another 3 to 5 years, and she would lose the ability to navigate ships through hyperspace. At that point, she'd leave the fleet and be rematched to one of the 9 ruling families. Thalias could remember vividly her own fear and uncertainty at that life change. Fortunately, she'd had a chance encounter with a young cadet Thrawn at the beginning of that time, and he'd given her words of comfort and encouragement that had helped her get through it. She could only hope that when Chiri's time came, she would be there to offer the girl similar support.
Yes, absolutely sure,
Chiri said firmly. Nevertheless, she threw a last lingering look at the green and gray high-collar tunic she'd also tried on.
That's the one.
Okay, great,
Thalias said, indicating to the shopkeeper that they were finally finished. And with money, closet space, and time now effectively used up, they needed to get moving.
We need to go straight back to the shuttle,
she told Chiri as she paid for the dress.
But you said we could get ice cream,
the girl protested.
That was about 2 dress fittings ago,
Thalias reminded her. She took another look at Chiri's face.
Ugh. All right, but at one of the kiosks, not a walk-in,
she amended.
And you eat it on the way, and you don't spill any on yourself.
Oh, please,
Chiri said, a look of mock reproof briefly interrupting her relieved smile.
I do know how to handle a spoon, you know.
Or spill any of it on me,
Thalias added, as she took the bagged dress and prodded Chiri toward the door. Excitement over a new dress. Excitement over ice cream. Straddling that line between child and mid-ager. When, she wondered, did children begin growing up so quickly? They were within sight of the Springhawk shuttle, and Chiri was cleaning the last of the ice cream from the inside of her cup when an elderly man waiting on a nearby bench stood up.
Mithaliestov,
he called.
I am she,
Thalias said, slowing and frowning as he strode toward them. She'd never seen him before, but he was wearing the Myth family crest on his jacket. Some local Naperar official?
I am Myth Iviklo,
he introduced himself, giving her a small bow.
Senior aide to Patriarch Mithurfianico, may I have a word with you?
Yes, if you're quick,
Thalias said, frowning a little harder.
What would someone from the Patriarch's office want with her? And then, like a punch in the stomach, the name clicked. Patriarch Mithurfianico. Thurfian. Back when he was a syndic, he'd pulled strings with an expansionary defense fleet personnel officer to cut through the bureaucratic obstacles and get her assigned as Chiri's caregiver aboard the Springhawk.
But the price of that favor had been her reluctant agreement to spy on Thrawn for him. Now, Thurfian was no longer just a syndic, but the head of the entire Myth family. Was he finally calling in that promise? If so, she needed to get out of here, and fast.
I'm sorry, but we really have to go,
she said, taking Chiri's arm and pulling her toward the shuttle.
This won't take long,
Thavik assured her, changing direction to intercept their new path. With his longer legs, it took only 4 steps for him to catch up.
I have something I was asked to deliver to you.
From Patriarch Thurfian?
Thalias asked. She desperately wanted to pick up her pace, to try to get away from him, even breaking into a full run if she had to. But if she did that, she would leave Chiri behind. There was no way she was going to do that.
No. This is from the late Patriarch, Thuraki,
Thavik said, producing a data cylinder from his pocket.
He left this with me before his death, with instructions to give it to you.
Thalia slowed to a stop, frowning at the cylinder in his hand.
If this was some kind of trick...
Patriarch Thuraki, you said?
You and he had a short conversation when you were last at the homestead,
Thavik said, as if Thalias would ever forget that unexpected meeting.
He told me afterward he was most impressed by you.
I was very impressed by him, too,
Thalias said, eyeing him closely.
Thus he decided you would be the best person to have this,
Thavik said. He stretched out his hand and the data cylinder toward her. Slowly, Thalias reached out and took it.
And it's from Patriarch Thuraki?
She asked again, just to make sure.
To be specific, the files were gathered and compiled by the late Syndic Mithrasiphus,
Thavik said.
He delivered the package to the Patriarch shortly before his death, where it has remained until now. One of the Patriarch's last instructions, as I said, was for me to privately deliver it to you at my earliest convenience.
The skin on the back of Thalias' neck tingled.
Privately? Did he say what I was supposed to do with it?
He said you would know when the time was right,
Thavik said.
And now, I believe you're due to return to your ship. Good day.
He smiled at Chiri.
To you both.
Thalias watched as he walked away, the data cylinder feeling hard and cold and mysterious in her hand.
Thalias?
Chiri murmured anxiously at her side.
It's all right.
Thalias soothed her, belatedly noticing that she was still gripping the girl's arm.
It's all right,
she repeated, letting go. She waited until Thavik had disappeared into the stream of other pedestrians. Then, putting a gentle hand on Chiri's shoulder, she turned and steered them toward the shuttle.
Come on,
she said, trying to sound cheerful and unconcerned.
We don't want to be late.
What did he give you?
Chiri asked.
Whatever's on this,
Thalias said, showing her the data cylinder.
Right now, I don't know any more than you do.
But we're going to find out, right?
I'm going to find out, Thalias corrected.
It might not be something you're allowed to see.
If I can see it, you'll tell me, right?
We'll see.
Does that mean yes?
It means we'll see,
Thalias said firmly.
Okay.
Chiri was silent another few steps.
Who is Syndic Thras?
He was one of the top myth in the Syndicure,
Thalias said.
He died a couple of years ago.
What does he have to do with you?
I don't know,
Thalias said, slipping the cylinder into a pocket. But she was absolutely, positively going to find out.
Memories, too.
Thras had seen Patriarch Mithor Akiord exactly 3 times in his life. The first 2 had been while visiting the homestead as a child. The 3rd was when he was a mid-ager, learning the protocols for transporting documents from Avidage to Chila. All 3 sightings had been from a distance, but just the same, Thras felt honored to have even glimpsed the man who'd guided the myth for the past 30 years. Even the majority of family blood never got such an opportunity. It was therefore a slightly unnerving surprise when a casual visit with his mother was abruptly interrupted by a summons to Thuraki's office. The patriarch was sitting behind his desk when Thras arrived, talking with senior aide Mithiviklo. The Rocky looked up as Thras was ushered in, gave a short nod in silent welcome, and returned to his conversation. Thras took the cue and stayed where he was, standing at the door, well out of earshot. Wondering whether he was here for some special honor, an assignment, or a particularly stinging reprimand. 2 years ago, while admiring Avidich artwork with Cadet Thrawn, Thras had used the word legendary to describe the 12th Patriarch. In his opinion, Patriarch Thraki had already exceeded even the 12th's record of accomplishments. His skillful diplomacy through the ever-shifting alliances among the ruling families had raised the myth from a relatively weak stance vis-a-vis the Irisi to full parity with their longtime rivals. Equally important, his work in building relationships within the 40 great families had further brought the myth out of the political stagnation they'd languished in as recently as a few decades ago. If this was an assignment, Thras would do his very best to accomplish it. If it was a reprimand, he would strive to face it with the proper humility and to learn from it. At the desk, the two men finished their conversation.
"Thras," Thuraki called, beckoning.
"Yes, Your Venerante,"
Thras said, hurrying forward.
"How may I serve?"
"I'm told you know a Taharim cadet. Actually, he'll have just graduated, a lieutenant in the expansionary defense fleet named Mithron Yuru. Is that correct?"
"I know him slightly, sir, yes," Thras said. If it was a reprimand, this was an odd way to begin. "We met at his welcoming dinner, and since then I've kept tabs on his time at the academy."
"Your opinion of him?"
"He has great potential, Your Venerante," Thras said, thinking quickly. His interest in Thrawn's progress had been fairly casual, and it had been several weeks since he'd looked at the Taharim records. Still, apart from that near fiasco with the training simulation, he couldn't remember hearing that Thrawn was having any problems. As to the simulation question, the fact that he'd not only gotten out from under the cloud, but emerged looking better than before, spoke volumes about his talents.
"I think he'll be a fine officer."
"Good," Thuraki said. "All the more urgency to your assignment, then. I'm told that the Stibler family is hoping to steal him away from us. I want you to go to Naperar, re-establish your old contact with him, and make sure that doesn't happen."
"Yes, sir," Thras said, a little uncertainly. The lack of a reprimand was reassuring, but this was the task he'd been brought into the Patriarch's office to receive? To keep a single merit adoptive from being grabbed by another family? And particularly by the Stibla? Certainly, that family had some impressive history, millennia ago, when the Chiss were first reaching outward to the stars. The Stibla had been the ruling family, guiding everything and everyone. But as time passed, and the ascendancy grew from one world to many, the Stibla Patriarch had decided the task of governance had become too overwhelming for a single family to handle. His solution had been to step aside and appoint three other families to rule in the Stibla's place. Thras could appreciate the family's contributions to the Ascendancy, but their time had long since passed, and they had to be delusional to think they could offer Thrawn anything better than what he currently had with the myth. But if Patriarch Thuraki was concerned about even such a minuscule chance of losing Thrawn to some smooth-talking Stibla, Thras should take it equally seriously. "I'll leave at once, Your Venerante," he said.
"Am I authorized to offer him any additional incentives?"
"Not at this time," Thuraki said.
But you might want to remind him that the friendship of the Mish family is worth having.
Thrawn had estimated it would take him 10 minutes to arrive at the bistro Thras had specified. Just out of curiosity, Thras set a timer. And exactly 8 minutes after his call, there was movement at the corner of his eye as someone pulled out one of the small table's 3 other chairs.
"Hello, Thrawn," Thras said, looking up.
The rest of the greeting froze in his throat. The middle-aged man sitting down beside him was a complete stranger.
Excuse me, but this table is taken, he said.
My apologies for the intrusion,
the stranger said calmly.
I thought it would save time if I joined you, given that we're both here to meet the same person. You're Aristarchus Mithrasophis, I presume.
Thras felt his eyes narrow. As a fairly low-level functionary in the Sindicure, his name and face were not exactly at the front edge of public knowledge.
I am he, he said cautiously. And you?
Stiblapen Psykok, the other said. Senior aide to Patriarch Stibla Miovodo. Congratulations on finalizing that Tumaz shipping contract, by the way. And right out from under the Arisi, too. Whoever the Myth Principal was on that negotiation, she's quite skillful.
I'm sure she is,
Thras murmured. Not only did this man know about the deal the Myth had just worked out with the Tumaz family, but he apparently even knew that the head of the Myth negotiating team was a woman.
You're very well informed.
Lapinsick shrugged.
The Stibla don't exactly dominate the list of the 40, he said, as if that fact had somehow escaped Thras's notice. We have to compensate for our lack of influence and successes by keeping track of everyone else's.
How the mighty have fallen,
Thras said under his breath.
We prefer to think of it as how the mighty have graciously stepped down,
Lapinsick said.
Speaking of Myth's successes, your Lieutenant Mithron Yuru seems well on his way to becoming one of them.
I agree, Thras said.
The key word being your.
Thrawn is a Myth, and we have every intention of keeping him.
A reasonable goal,
Lapinsick said.
Though I would remind you that intent and result don't necessarily coincide. I imagine the Stibla could offer him more incentives than the Myth have, at least thus far.
Thras gave him a knowing smile, even as his stomach knotted up. Now, when it was too late, he wished he'd pressed Patriarch Thuraki harder on the whole incentives question. With Thrawn currently at the very lowest Myth rank, anything higher that was offered would be a strong inducement to be rematched. Even to a family like the Stibla.
Perhaps,
he said, trying to sound casual.
Of course, he would have to assess the relative advantages of being a Myth versus being a Stibla.
Lieutenant Thrawn is intelligent enough to make that calculation,
Lapinsick said, giving Thras a knowing smile of his own.
Or will it soon be Lieutenant Laron?
The name has a nice ring to it, don't you think?
A figure among the stream of pedestrians a block away caught Thras's eye. Thrawn had rounded the corner and was striding toward them.
So, tell me, Aristocra Thras,
Lapinsick said, his smile fading.
What can you offer Thrawn that I can't?
Is that a question or a challenge?
Take it however you wish.
Lapinsick nodded down the street.
But take it quickly. Once he sits down, he will hear my proposal.
Thras looked at Thrawn, his mind racing. What could he offer? Higher status? He wasn't authorized to do that. Advancement in military rank? That was completely in the hands of the Defense Hierarchy Council. Money? Ridiculous. There was nothing. Nothing. Except maybe
You see him a shiny new piece the Stibler can add to the political board, he said, looking back at Lapinsick. But that's all you see.
And you think the myths see more?
I don't know what the myths see, Thrass said. All I know is what I see.
Which is...
Thrass took a deep breath. The young, socially awkward cadet, fascinated by artwork. The unique ability to understand that artwork, while beneath the intellect was the quiet pain of a hidden loss. The newly commissioned officer, who had already shown such a depth of tactical ability that he'd attracted allies, like Junior Commander Ziara and General Bakif to his side. What exactly did he see in Thrawn? And then, Patriarch Thuraki's last admonition to him drifted up from his memory. Now, he finally understood what the Patriarch had really been saying.
What I see, he said, is a friend. My friend.
For a long moment, the two of them locked eyes. Then a small smile tweaked at Lapinsick's lips.
Really? He said. Interesting.
There was a motion across the table. Thrass turned, slightly startled to see Thrawn sit down. Focused on Lapinsick and his own musings, he completely missed the other's final approach. And it had indeed been exactly 10 minutes.
Hello, Thrawn,
he greeted the other, reaching across the table for a quick formal grasp of forearms.
I'm glad you could make it.
As am I, Thrawn said. Thank you for working around my schedule.
He looked at Lapinsick.
I don't believe we've met.
No, we haven't,
Lapinsick acknowledged.
I'm Stib Lapinsaikok, senior aide to Patriarch Stib Lami Ovodo.
Thrass braced himself. This was it. Lapinsick would make his offer, and Thrass had nothing to counter it.
And then, to his surprise, Lapinsick pushed back his chair and stood up.
And I was just leaving, he added. Enjoy your meal and your conversation.
He looked at Thrass, and it seemed to him there was an odd sense of satisfaction in his nod.
Both of you.
A friend of yours?
Thrawn asked, as Lapinsick wove his way into the pedestrian flow.
Actually, we just met,
Thrass said, frowning at Lapinsick's back.
What in the name of Chila had just happened? Had the Stibler been playing him?
Him and Patriarch Thuraki?
If they had, so what? Really, so what?
This depth of political game was far beyond Thrass's position or skill. The Patriarchs and Speakers and high-level syndics could play if they wanted. Not Thrass. All he was here for was to have lunch with a friend.
But never mind him,
he continued, pulling up the bistro's menu and swiveling his questus around so that Thrawn could also see the listing.
Let's get our order in. After that, I want to hear more about this Junior Commander Ziara, who single-handedly saved your career.
It wasn't quite like that,
Thrawn protested mildly.
Then tell me how exactly it was, Thrass said. Because when I tell the story later to prove to people why the myth are the finest of the ruling families, I want to get all the details right.
What if the details don't support that slightly biased conclusion?
Oh, I'm sure they will,
Thrass said with a smile.
Really? The only thing that will change about the story is how smug I let myself sound when I tell it.
Chapter 4 Patriarch Thurfian's childhood was far behind him, but he could still remember bits and pieces of it. One of the most vivid memories was of a stormy day
when he and his three siblings had tired of other activities and started a spontaneous indoor game with rules that were mostly made up, and only when the need for one arose. Madcap running had quickly become part of it, the chase ranging through the entire house with noise and laughter, and a fair amount of bumping into walls and furniture. Their mother's secretary had intervened twice, and the housekeeper and security guard once each. None of them had achieved any noticeable success. Finally, their mother had paused the meeting she'd been moderating and taken a personal hand, corralling her rambunctious offspring and finally bringing the chaotic frenzy to a halt, or at least back down to a low simmer. One of the most striking parts of Thurfian's memory was the stressed look on her face as she herded them to the dining nook and ordered a snack that would hopefully keep them occupied long enough for her to finish her meeting. Frenzied activity. Few, if any, rules. Children who didn't want to stop doing something just because someone said so. His mother's harried expression. Now, as patriarch, all these years later, he finally knew exactly how she'd felt. Especially right now.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, Your Venerante,
Patriel Thistrian of Abadich said.
I know you must be extremely busy, what with settling into your new position and all.
I'm always available for consultation with my Patriels,
Thurfian said, suppressing a grimace. Thistrian had been the myth speaker when Thurfian was first made an aristocrat and brought into the Sindicure. And while Thurfian had learned a lot from him, he'd never forgotten how garrulous the old man could get when the mood struck him. Hopefully today wouldn't be one of those days.
What's this matter of possible importance I'm told you wish to discuss?
I'm actually a bit unclear on that,
Thistrian confessed.
I've just had a conversation with an alien who tells me there's some kind of new alliance brewing between the Dasklo, Zodlak, Aragol, and Pomrio. He included part of a video...
Hold it! Thurfian interrupted. What alien? When?
His name is Jixtus, and it was about an hour ago that we spoke,
Thistrian said.
He's traveling with a group of aliens called the Kilgees.
Hold on,
Thurfian said, punching up the latest Defense Force data feed. Hadn't there just been something about an alien warship showing up unannounced over Avidich? Yes, there it was.
Are you talking about the battlecruiser that arrived 2 hours ago?
Yes, that's the one,
Thistrian confirmed.
Not all that impressive, actually, as warships go. It would probably do well enough against pirates, but it would be no match for Avidich System Patrol. Actually, our family frigate and missile boats could probably take it. I had the frigate moved into combat position, but really, there doesn't seem to be a need.
Is he still there?
Oh, yes,
Thistrian said, as if that should be obvious.
But really, Your Venerante, you don't need to worry. Patrol Command says the missile tubes and lasers have all been peace-sealed, so there's really no danger. And as I said, the patrol ships and our frigate are in position.
Very well,
Thurfian said. The presence of an alien warship in Chiss space, peace-sealed or not, was definitely cause for concern. But if Patrol Command said it was safe, it probably was.
So why exactly are you calling me?
I was getting to that,
Thistrian said.
As I was saying, he showed me part of a vid that seems to show a group of Aragol and Zodlak ships play-attacking an armed freighter while a Dasklo ship looks on.
Thurfian frowned. The Aragol part he could understand. They were already longtime Dasklo allies. But the Zodlak? That was an odd combination.
For what purpose?
As I said, the Aragol and Zodlak seemed to be practicing an attack. with the Dasklo either supervising or just there to watch.
Yes, I know you just said that,
Thurfian said, his mother's stressed expression once again flashing to mind.
I meant, what was Gixtus's reason for showing it to you?
I believe he wants to sell us additional information,
Thistrian said.
The location of the incident, confirmation of the participants, perhaps more details on the purpose of the test, that sort of thing.
Very helpful of him,
Thurfian said.
Do you have a copy of that vid?
Yes, of course,
Thistrian said.
Though the part he gave me is only about 5 seconds long. Here, I'll show it to you.
His image disappeared from the display, replaced by a group of 5 blurry ships set against a starry background. 3 of the ships were trading low-level laser shots with a freighter-sized vessel, while the 5th ship floated a little way off. As Thistrian had said, the vid only lasted a few seconds.
And Gixtus says the attackers are Aragol and Zodlak ships?
He asked.
No. Gixtus didn't say anything about their identities,
Thistrian said, his image replacing the starscape.
I had my people run it through an enhancer, then spoke to my military advisors.
You have an enhanced version?
Thurfian demanded.
Why didn't you send that instead?
I assumed you'd first want to see the product Gixtus wants to sell us,
Thistrian said, a little stiffly.
Here's our version.
Once again, his face was replaced by a vid. But where the ship images had previously been blurry, now they were sharp and clear. The 3 attackers were a cruiser and 2 patrol craft. The cruiser and 1 patrol ship bearing Zodlak insignia, the other patrol ship marked as Aragol. The freighter at the center of the exercise didn't seem to have any markings. And the larger ship standing off the action, a frigate, Thistrian's experts identified it, did indeed carry the Dasklo family crest.
So the Dasklo are watching some Aragol and Zodlak run a play battle,
Thurfian said.
And this Gixtus wants us to pay him for this meager meal of information?
Your Venerante, I'm not sure you understand,
Thistrian said.
If this is the prelude to the Dasklo adding the Zodlak and possibly the Pomrio to their list of allies, we could be facing a serious challenge.
I suppose that's possible,
Thurfian said.
I'll make some inquiries.
He's also offering military assistance, should we desire it,
Thistrian said.
He says he has other warships at his disposal that could reach the Ascendancy with just a few days' warning.
Thurfian felt his eyes narrow. Offering information was one thing. Offering 1 of the 9, a group of alien mercenaries, was not just outrageous, but could easily be construed as a deadly insult. Not to mention that even a casual reading of the Ascendancy's ancient history showed how destructive and ultimately futile foreign alliances could be.
I would strongly suggest he keep his warships out of Chiss space,
he growled.
You can tell him that. You can also tell him that the Myth are declining his offer and that he had best be on his way.
Your Venerante, if I may suggest...
Thank you for bringing this to my attention,
Thurfian said, reaching for the comm control.
Farewell, Patriel.
Before Thistrian could protest further, he cut the link. For a moment, he gazed at the blank screen, thinking it through. The offer of military aid he could dismiss without a second thought. But what about this supposed Dasklo-Zodlak alliance? Was such a thing even possible? It seemed unlikely. The Zodlak were firmly in the Arisi orbit, unlikely to leave that comfortable position without a severe and visible push. As for the Dasklo, for the past 30 years, their full attention had been on their private little power struggle against the Klar. During that time, they hadn't paid much attention to the rest of the Syndicure politics, and Thurfian didn't expect that to change anytime soon. And he should know. At Speaker Thyklo's request, he'd spent much of his final 3 months in the Syndicure running profiles and assessments of all 9 ruling families, watching in particular for signs of dissension, overt clashes, and possible upcoming realignments. He hadn't quite finished his analysis of the 40 great families when Patriarch Thuraki's death unexpectedly raised him to his new position. But he'd completed enough to conclude that the current political web was remarkably stable. No, the Klar might believe monster stories about the Dasklo, but the myth weren't going to fall for such nonsense. If the Ascendancy fell into crisis, it would be because individuals like Senior Captain Thrawn did something that pushed it over the edge. Still, it wouldn't hurt to have the Homestead techs take a look at the vid and see if any additional information could be teased out of it. He logged the order, then put the whole thing out of his mind. There were plenty of more urgent family issues to attend to. And later, when he found himself in need of a break from patriels, counselors, and inter-family maneuverings, he would see if there was any news on where Thrawn and the Springhawk had apparently disappeared to. Arilani finished reading through the report and looked up at Supreme General Barkeef, waiting silently behind his desk.
"Well, we were half right," she said.
"More than half, I'd say," Barkeef said. "You'd tagged the station as a repair and refurbishing site. You just didn't know the kind of refurbishing work it was doing."
"And they're sure it's Nyx's hull work?" Arilani asked. "We looked at what the team collected on our way back, and I didn't see any Nyx there."
"The analysts are sure," Barkeef said. "Of course, they're basing much of that on the misfire burns in the decks, so they could be wrong."
"Not likely," Arilani conceded, looking at the relevant part of the report. "They're right. Class 6 cutting torches are the tool of choice for working Nyx's alloy. I think we can take their word that the depth and width suggest that the plates or enhancements were relatively thin. So our friends with the Battle Dreadnought are upgrading their hull armor."
"Or else adding armor to a ship that normally doesn't have it," Barkeef said. "A scout, perhaps? Or a freighter? Or civilian transport?"
"Hard to see what kind of advantage they think that'll give them," Arilani said. "A Nyx's alloy hull is pretty obvious, even before you get into full combat range, so it's not going to be a surprise to anyone. And something as thin as the analysts are talking about won't provide much protection."
"Perhaps the plan is to add to an existing hull," Barkeef suggested. "Or they were armoring a freighter or transport, and then adding another layer of standard hull metal on top of it as camouflage."
Arilani made a face.
"Either way, it looks like that freighter-sized ship wasn't the mobile dock that we thought it was. The mounting nodes we spotted were for attaching new hull segments, and the analysts don't think that was the first job they'd done there."
"That's what they conclude from the number and placement of the torch burns," Barkeef said. "No way of knowing how many ships had already passed through, and it was obviously not yet working at full capacity, but it does indeed appear to have been up and running."
"And alien freighters and other transports visited the Ascendancy all the time."
"I presume we're going to make sure it's shut down permanently."
"I've recommended that action to the Council," Barkeef said. "Whether they and the Syndicure approve is another question."
He shrugged slightly.
"Though now that you've caught the Battle Dreadnought's friends in the middle of a job, I'm guessing the Council will assume they'll write it off."
we can hope.
Aralani shook her head.
So Yves builds a station out in the middle of nowhere. Our mystery people let him do it, then wreck it, kill all the Nicardun there, and move in. I'm still not getting the why of it.
Maybe the middle of nowhere is exactly where they want it to be,
Bakeef pointed out.
I'll also point out that this particular patch of emptiness is conveniently positioned between Sunrise and the Ascendancy.
Yes, we'd noticed that.
Good, Bakeef gestured to her. Let's run through the timeline, shall we?
Yes, sir.
Aralani paused, collecting her thoughts.
General Yiv and the Nicardun move into this region, conquering small nations and threatening the Ascendancy. At roughly the same time, someone discovers that Sunrise has massive Nyx deposits and starts a civil war there to give them free access to the ore.
Two questions,
Bakeef said, lifting a finger.
First, do we know that an outsider started that war, as opposed to it being something homegrown? Second, has it been confirmed that Sunrise was the source of the Nyx that the Agbui were waving under Councillor Lekuviv's nose on Selwys?
I don't think we know for sure about the war,
Aralani said.
Though the timing is a strong indicator, especially since some of Yiv's forces were quick to chase the Sunrise refugee group to Rapak.
Also, especially since the asteroid missile technique we've seen ties the battle dreadnought to the attack on the Nicardun bases,
Bakeef said.
And the Nyx?
Tron's report says the mages identified the Selwys jewelry as being made on Sunrise,
Aralani said.
But of course her assessment is hardly proof.
Agreed,
Bakeef said.
Now add in a few other points. The Battle Dreadnought aliens apparently persuaded Yiv to build that base, knowing full well they were going to attack it and kill all the Nicardun there. The asteroid attack alone shows that it was a long-term plan. That means that not only did Yiv trust them, but also that he was ignorant of their overall strategies.
Yes, I see,
Aralani said slowly.
And since the Agbui used some of that same Nyx in whatever their plan was at Hoxim, that suggests the Agbui and the Battle Dreadnought are working together.
Which further suggests a coordinated operation,
Bakeef said grimly.
An attack from the outside by the Nicardun, an attack from the inside by the Agbui, and now...
He tapped his questis, sending her a report.
We have this. I gather from your lack of any comment when you first arrived that you are unaware of it.
Aralani felt her eyes narrow as she skimmed through the report. An alien ship? An alien warship had entered the Ascendancy?
Yes, sir. Completely,
she gritted out, pulling out her comm.
When did this happen?
The ship arrived at Avidich 4 hours ago,
Bakeef told her.
You were probably testifying about Sunrise in front of the Sindicure Hearing Committee at the time.
Yes, I was,
Aralani said, swallowing a curse as she pulled up her comm's message listing. Senior flag officers were supposed to receive automatic alerts when there was any kind of threat against the Ascendancy. Most Sindicure committees, unfortunately, insisted witnesses turn off their comms during questioning. But she'd checked her messages after leaving the chamber, and there'd been nothing there about an alien warship. As she skimmed through them now, there still wasn't.
You won't see anything,
Bakeef said, a hint of acid in his tone.
After the initial report went out, someone in the council apparently decided there was no reason to panic the public, so the notifications were withdrawn.
With all respect, Supreme General, that was a stupid decision,
Aralani said.
The whole idea of alerts is so that the military can be ready if potential trouble appears. We can't do that if we don't know about it.
She held up her comm.
And the public doesn't see these anyway.
I know, Bekeef said. But the warship was reported to be peace-sealed, and it left Avidich 2 hours after it arrived, so...
It left?
Aralani interrupted.
Who authorized that?
Apparently the Myth Patriel told them they could go, and Patrol Command didn't object, Bekeef said. Though they didn't have much choice, given that the alien hadn't attacked anyone or even behaved aggressively.
They could have at least tried to keep it there until a defense force ship could be sent.
Actually, the Ventress was already en route, Bekeef said. But the alien was gone when it arrived.
His lip twitched.
And as I said, they hadn't been the least bit hostile.
Aralani unclenched her teeth. No. Patrol Command probably hadn't had any other option. In general, she agreed with the strict ascendancy policy of never taking the first shot, even when facing a blatant threat. But there were times when she sympathized with Thrawn's view that allowing an enemy to control the timing and location of hostilities was foolish.
So it's still wandering around?
Apparently, Bekeef said. But all patrol commands are on the alert, and the Defense Force has ships ready to move if and when it shows up again.
I hope they're faster on the uptake than they were this time,
Aralani said.
You said the Myth told them they could go?
Yes, Bekeef said. Apparently someone aboard had a conversation with the Myth Patriel before they left. The topic of that discussion is still unclear, but Patriarch Thurfian has been in contact with us and is putting together a full report.
And if any of that discussion put the Myth in a bad light, Aralani had no doubt that those particular aspects would quietly disappear.
What do you want me to do, sir?
I had planned to ask you to put together a Sunrise Task Force proposal we could present to the Council,
Bekeef said ruefully.
Even if the planet itself remains off-limits, we should be able to make a case that the Battle Dreadnought or its successors attacked you and are therefore legitimate targets.
But now we have an unknown alien warship poking around.
So it would seem, Bekeef said. Which puts anything having to do with Sunrise off onto a side table.
Very convenient for someone.
I agree, Bekeef said. But we're not going to convince the Sindicure to let us focus our attention anywhere except on the Ascendancy itself.
I assume you're pulling in all the expansionary defense fleet ships to bolster the planetary patrols.
Not all of them, Bekeef said. The Council and Sindicure are still working out the numbers and details. But yes, most will probably be brought back in and redeployed.
He raised his eyebrows.
The Vigilant will definitely be one of them.
I hope they understand that the situation at Sunrise isn't something that can simply be set aside until a less inconvenient time,
Aralani warned.
Someone with serious military power is willing to take on Chiss warships in order to keep the place to themselves. We need answers. And delaying our investigation just gives our enemies more time.
I'm not the one you need to convince, Admiral,
Bekeef reminded her.
Would you like me to set up a meeting with the Council or the Sindicure so you can plead your case?
You think it would do any good?
Not really, no, Bekeef said. But you're welcome to try.
Probably not worth the effort, Aralani conceded. So the Vigilant is going on defense duty?
Yes, at least for the time being,
Bekeef said, picking up his Questus and touching a key.
Ah! They've worked out the preliminaries. The Greyshrike, Ventress. Ah, there we go. The vigilant's been assigned to Spasia.
Aralani wrinkled her nose. But at least Spasia was one of the Ascendancy's more vital worlds. Better than being sent out to Kynos or Rigar, or somewhere else on the physical or cultural fringes.
Understood, sir. With your permission, I'll alert my officers and return to my ship.
Very good, Admiral, Bekeef said. And I will keep up the pressure on the Council regarding Sunrise.
Thank you, sir.
Aralani stood up, straightened a moment in respect, then started to turn to the door, and paused.
A moment, sir, she said, turning back. You said you'd be willing to set me up with a meeting.
Of course, Bekeef said. Who do you want to talk to?
Aralani braced herself. The Supreme General, she was pretty sure, wasn't going to like this. The Supreme General didn't. Enlightenment, according to an ancient Kilji dictum, was seldom an individual's first choice. But that choice could be changed, the dictum continued. And it was the duty of each and every enlightened to facilitate each and every such change. There was another dictum, one that spoke of those who foolishly and defiantly stood against that goal. Their fate, unlike the choice of enlightenment, could not be changed.
You lied to me,
Nakir said. Jixtus's hooded head lifted, the veiled face rising from the reading device he'd been studying.
Excuse me.
You lied to me,
Nakir repeated.
Tell me now why I should not have you removed from my ship.
For a moment, Jixtus remained motionless. Then, moving slowly and deliberately, he turned off his reader and set it on the table beside him.
You make a serious charge, he said. Would you care to explain it?
You told me you would bring enlightenment to these cheese,
Nakir said.
Yet you permitted the Myth Cheese to order us away without even allowing me to speak of the path to him.
I never said all Chiss would be enlightened,
Jixtus said.
Indeed, I expect most of them will resist to the point of leaving their dead bodies in our wake.
You said the defiance would come only from the leaders and commanders,
Nakir countered.
You said those leaders would die, but that a remnant of the common people would eagerly accept enlightenment.
So I did,
Jixtus acknowledged.
And so they shall.
Yet you allowed this Myth Cheese leader to go his way.
Would you have preferred I ordered the Whetstone to bombard the planet from space?
Jixtus asked.
Why not?
Nakir demanded.
They have nothing that holds Terra for us. We've seen the insignificant defenders that guard their worlds. We've seen the larger but still pitiful warship they use to travel outside the nest of ignorance and darkness. Why not bring them enlightenment right here and now?
For a moment, Jixtus was silent.
There is a star system to the side of our current path,
he said. He picked up his reader, tapped a control, and handed the device to Nakir.
It lies at the end of this vector. Order your vassals to take us there, and I shall answer your questions.
Nakir looked at the numbers, his skin stretching in contempt. Jixtus was stalling for time, of course. The tricks of the unenlightened were both obvious and pathetic.
Why do you wish to go there?
Order your vassals to take us there, and I shall answer your questions.
Nakir could ignore the request, of course. He could force Jixtus to answer, or begin the Grisk's first steps on the path to enlightenment. But both could be interpreted as fear. Fear of Jixtus, or fear of the unknown. And the enlightened were never to show fear.
Vassal one, alter course to this victor and seize them,
he commanded, handing Jixtus's reader to the pilot.
I obey,
Vassal One said. He peered at the numbers a moment, then keyed the new course into the helm.
How far?
Nakir asked.
It is close, General Arias,
Vassal One said.
Approximately 35 minutes.
Increase speed,
Nakir ordered.
Make it 10.
Vassal One rippled with surprise and some concern.
I obey.
The sound of the Whetstone's engines rose in pitch as Vassal One ran them to full power. Nakir turned back to Jixtus in malicious amusement. If the Grisk had counted on having a full 35 minutes with which to prepare an explanation or craft an apology, he would now have to work more quickly. Was he even now feeling the fear of the unknown that so often enmeshed the unenlightened? But as always, there was nothing to be seen, either of fear or anything else. Jixtus remained silent and motionless, his robe, hood, and veil fully concealing whatever stress or concern or arrogance might be lurking within. For a moment, Nakir considered walking over to him and tearing away the coverings so as to finally see this unenlightened alien he'd allowed to travel aboard his ship. He resisted the urge. He was General Arias of the Kilji Illumin. Such actions, like fear itself, were beneath his dignity. Besides, unless Jixtus could make an acceptable apology for his lack of action at the Chiss world, the alien's enlightenment would soon begin, and all his secrets would be revealed. Until then, he could keep his face hidden and those secrets buried. Cultivating his patience, Nakir turned away from the unenlightened and gazed out the Whetstone's canopy at the swirling disorder that was hyperspace. The minutes passed in silence. Then Vassal One called a warning, and the disorder gave way once again to the proper harmony of the universe's starry sky. In the near distance, Nakir could see a half-darkened world. In the far distance was a dully glowing sun.
Your last request has been granted,
Nakir said, turning back to Jixtus.
I will have answers now.
The answers will arrive momentarily, Jixtus said. In fact, they should be arriving now.
From behind Nakir came a soft gasp and the sound of skin rippling against clothing.
General Arias,
Vassal Two called in a strangled voice. Nakir turned. Floating in front of the Whetstone, drifting into view from around the war cruiser's starboard side, was another warship. But not just any warship.
This craft was huge. 3, possibly even 4 times bigger than the Whetstone. The bow bristled with clusters of spectrum lasers, with more lasers and missile tubes pointed toward the Kilgees from the massive weapons shoulders. Lines of running lights marked the flanks and dorsal spine, accenting the warship's length and sheer presence.
"Do you see that warship?" Jixtus asked quietly from behind him, the words seeming to float in front of Nakir's stunned disbelief, in much the same way that the warship facing him floated in front of the stars.
"That is the Fate Spinner, a Grisk Shatterclass war master. It could destroy the Whetstone in 10 minutes. It could turn your entire Killhorde battle fleet to scrap in 2 hours. Do you hear and understand, General Arius Nakir?"
Nakir felt his skin rippling, his eyes and thoughts still frozen. That ship!
"Do you hear me, General Arius?"
Nakir found his voice.
"Yes,"
he said.
"Then hear and understand,"
Jixtus said. His voice was still quiet, but now there was an edge of dark threat beneath it.
"You serve the Grisks. The Illumin serves the Grisks. You and your people live or die at the pleasure of the Grisks. I do not travel aboard the Whetstone at your pleasure. Rather, you and the Whetstone survive at mine. I will travel aboard this ship wherever I wish, for as long as I wish. And you will obey every command I choose to give. Do you understand?"
Nakir forced himself back to a semblance of calm. "The Enlightened are never to show fear."
"And what of our agreement?"
he asked.
"It still stands,"
Jixtus assured him.
"We'll assist you in bringing enlightenment to the peoples of this region, but it will be the peoples of our choice and on our schedule."
Nakir's mind was still struggling. If Jixtus had access to such ships, why did he need the Kilgee Illumin? Certainly the Grisks could conquer the peoples of the Chaos all by themselves. Was their talk of enlightenment and conquest merely a way to keep the Kilgees busy and out of their way, while they strode unseen along their own path? Why had Jixtus even requested transport aboard the Whetstone? He felt a stretching of shame. That last question, at least, he could now answer. No Chiss would stop to listen to Jixtus's message of warning if he arrived in a warship like that. They would open fire, and the war would be on. Nakir couldn't imagine what kind of warships the Chiss must have if Jixtus wanted them weakened before that happened. But those warships must be awesome indeed if the Grisks hesitated to launch a direct assault with ships like the Fate Spinner. In the end, though, those details didn't matter. What mattered was that Jixtus still needed Nakir's assistance, and in return would help the Kilgees spread enlightenment. Whatever was about to happen between the Grisks and the Chiss was none of the Illumin's concern.
"Understood,"
he said. Tearing his gaze from the warship, he turned back to Jixtus.
"What now?"
"I'll go aboard the Fate Spinner for consultation and any updates the captain has for me,"
Jixtus said.
"Then you and I will continue on."
He paused, the hooded head inclining slightly to the side.
and have no fears about my abilities or plans. Approaching the myth first wasn't a mistake. I knew their patriarch would turn us down.
Nakir drew himself up. Just because the Grisks had overwhelming force didn't mean he should humble himself before this alien. The Illumin had enlightenment, and with enlightenment came wisdom. The Grisks had neither the one nor the other.
Then why waste our time with him?
My time is never wasted,
Jixtus said.
Do you give up hopes of enlightening someone merely because your first attempt was rebuffed? Of course not. That's why the Kilgis need to add conquest to their tools, so as to have more time to enlighten those other beings.
Then you expect a myth to eventually listen to you?
Nakir asked, thoroughly confused now.
Not at all,
Jixtus said.
My time with the myth was to provide a baseline, a plumb against which all our future interactions with the Chiss will be measured.
I see,
Nakir said. He didn't, but he had no intention of admitting that to this alien.
Good.
Jixtus stood up.
The shuttle from the Fate Spinner will be here shortly to take me aboard. While I'm gone, you will prepare a course for the Chiss planet Rigar.
He paused, and Nakir had the eerie sense that the unseen face behind the veil was smiling.
There, we will find the patriarch of the Klar family, and our first true target.
Chapter 5.
Klar family Captain Klar Uskulri was in her office, working on her second cup of hot cacao leaf, when she got the alert that an alien ship had arrived over Rigar. She was at the Klar Homestead Defense Center in 30 seconds flat.
Duty officer!
She invited briskly as she strode to the command chair in the middle of the ring of displays and sat down.
Single alien warship moving into high orbit, Lieutenant Klarupi Ovmos replied just as briskly. Configuration and size match the battle cruiser that was reported over Avidich 2 days ago. The three Klar destroyers that were in that sector are moving to intercept, and the two frigates have taken up equatorial guard positions in case this is a feint or first of a two-prong. System patrols ships are moving into backup positions. Roscu nodded, running her eyes over the displays. Battlecruiser wasn't so much a specific class as it was a convenient label for mid-sized alien ships until their capabilities could be better defined. In this particular case, factoring in the earlier reports from the Myth Patrial on Avidich, she would tentatively place it between a Chiss frigate and a heavy cruiser, probably at the smaller end of that range. If it decided to be a problem, the patrol ships plus the Klar destroyers orbiting Rigar ought to be able to handle it. No indication of hostile intent, I presume?
No, ma'am, Rubiov said. And the destroyers report the alien weapons are peace-sealed. They've hailed us in Mies Kauf, Ta'arja, and Minisiat, but I assumed you'd want to respond to them in person.
Yes, I would,
Roscu confirmed with a flicker of satisfaction. It had taken a while to whip the Homestead Defense Forces into shape when she'd first taken this job, but they were finally starting to act like proper military professionals. Rubiov, in particular, was rapidly becoming an excellent second-in-command.
Do they sound particularly fluent in any of the languages?
Their Ta'arja is probably the cleanest, Rubiov said. Unfortunately, that's the hardest for most of us.
We didn't do things in the expansionary defense fleet because they were easy, Lieutenant,
Roscu said tartly.
We did things because they needed to be done. Give me calm. You have calm, Captain.
Roscoe cleared her throat.
This is Captain Roscoe, commander of the Klar Family Homestead Defense Force,
she said into Arja, trying not to wince. It really was an unpleasant language for the Chiss vocal apparatus.
Identify yourself and state the purpose of your visit to the Chiss Ascendancy.
I'm called Jesus.
An alien voice came back, raspy yet strangely melodious. The Ta'arja words were clear and precise, but there was a hint of a strange accent beneath them.
I travel with General Arius Nakir aboard the Kilji warship Whetstone. I've come to your world to deliver your patriarch a warning.
Roscoe felt her eyes narrow. Myth Patriarch Thurfian's report had been suspiciously sketchy on what this Jixtus and the Myth Patriel on Abadich had talked about.
Explain,
she said, turning her attention to the tactical display. The three Klar destroyers were already in attack positions, and the planet's general patrol ships were closing in at backup positions.
What sort of warning?
I believe your family to be in danger,
Jixtus said.
I ask permission to speak about the threat directly with your patriarch.
The Klar family is flattered by your solicitude, Roscoe said. May I ask why you're being so helpful?
Jixtus chuckled, a dry, raspy sound.
For payment, of course,
he said.
I'm a broker of information. I learn from those who have secrets, then sell to those who would best profit from those secrets.
I see,
Roscoe said. At least he wasn't pitching a tale of selfless altruism or something equally ridiculous. She didn't have much respect for mercenaries, but she did understand them.
I'm sure you'll understand that I can't disturb Patriarch Rivlex without something more on this threat than merely your word as to its supposed existence. If you'll provide me with the details, I can decide whether or not to bring it to his attention.
Will you also then be the judge on whether payment is justified?
Jixtus asked pointedly.
Your offer carries the risk of enriching you while impoverishing me.
You're a stranger to the Chiss Ascendancy, Roscoe said. You may therefore be forgiven your suggestion that the Klar family would cheat you. I assure you that your information will receive full payment for its value.
That value to be judged by you, of course.
Jixtus gave a sort of whistling sigh.
I suppose I have no other choice. Very well. If you will give landing instructions to my shuttle pilot, I shall come down and deliver to you the details of this threat.
There's no need for that,
Roscoe told him. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw one of the status displays change, and she looked over to see a new message. Defense Force Ship Ventress en route. ETA 3 hours. She made a face. 3 hours? So much for the Defense Force's highly touted ability to protect the Ascendancy. Fortunately for the people of Regal, the Klar were ready.
This communication is secure,
she said.
You can give me the details right here and now.
Is it secure?
Jixtus countered.
Are the Klar, then, alone on your world?
Roscoe frowned.
What do you mean by that?
I mean, this threat is not coming from outside,
Jixtus said, lowering his voice as if afraid others were listening in.
The danger is, in fact, coming from others of your kind.
Roscoe sent another look at the tactical. After the Ascendancy's tangle with General Yiv, she'd assumed Chixtus's alleged threat would come from the remnant of the Nicardoon forces, or possibly from someone new arriving in Yiv's wake. For that matter, the threat might even be Chixtus and these Kilgees he was riding with. But from the Chiss themselves? Ridiculous. None of the other nine would be foolish enough to take on the Klar. Unless, of course, by threat, he meant some political machinations were in the works. That sort of thing happened all the time, and the Klar and their allies could deal with that without paying some meddlesome alien for information they probably already had. Still, that was an alien warship up there. Even if Jixtus's information was a waste of time, there might be other ways Roscoe could gain from this encounter.
Understood, she said. Unfortunately, the Patriarch's standing policy is to refuse landing permission to non-Chiss vessels.
I understand,
Jixtus said.
With danger pressing so closely all around you, you would be unwise indeed to allow an unknown into your midst. A shuttle's worth of soldiers within your very gates could inflict unspeakable damage.
Roscoe felt her eyes narrow. Threats of danger she could hear and dismiss, but insults against her and the Klar family were another matter.
You don't know much about the Chiss if you think even one shuttle would be any threat to us, she said. Your entire warship would represent little more than an exercise for our defending forces.
What did you say?
Jixtus said, sounding almost flustered.
How did you know?
Roscoe looked at Rupiov, got a puzzled shrug in reply.
How did I know what? She asked.
That the threat is indeed represented by a war exercise,
Jixtus said.
How did you know of your enemy ship's practice attack?
Wait a